Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of Society for Armenian Studies podcast. Today we have with us Professor Aylin Koçunyan, who is currently a lecturer at Bilgi University in Istanbul and teaches seminars on the sociology of law, the history of civilizations, and of international relations. Today we will be speaking about her latest book, which was published by Peters Levin in May of 2018, entitled Negotiating the Ottoman Constitution from 1839 till 1876. So Aylin, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
So, can you briefly tell us what the term negotiating is about in the title? So, who are these negotiators and what are they trying to negotiate?
Yes, surely. I entitled the book Negotiating the Ottoman Constitution because there is a multi-layered negotiation within the elaboration process of the Ottoman Constitution. The negotiation is over concepts, how the concepts are negotiated between the draftsmen who tried to write a constitution for the Ottoman Empire. I think the book shows that an internal lawmaking process goes beyond the national narrative because there is also a negotiation with external actors in the sense that there is a world time and people are aware of the improvements that occurred in the external world in terms of lawmaking processes. And also the 1870s, we talk about the 1870s, so it's a period in which the world is well connected, and it's a period in which the Ottoman press also is very much developed and talks about the latest improvements in terms of lawmaking processes at the world scale. So in that respect, I think inevitably people are aware of constitutional developments in the external world, and they follow very well all the processes, and they think about how to conceptualize a constitutional framework for the Ottoman Empire by trying to adapt these constitutional frameworks to the Ottoman reality. And also there is an internal negotiation because all the bureaucrats who were involved in this constitution-making process, they had different origins, they had different legal norms, they come from different religious backgrounds. So in that respect, they don't have the same conceptualization of law. That's why they negotiate over the conceptualization and the elaboration of a constitution. So it's a multi-layered negotiation, and also it's a negotiation with the great powers, not because the great powers really supported the Ottoman constitution, but starting from the 1839, I think they continuously addressed reform proposals to the Ottoman Empire, and in that respect they proposed improvements, and the Ottoman Constitution comes as a response to these reform proposals to save Ottoman sovereignty.
Well, the book is a very timely work, since if we think of the parallels in nowadays, Turkey is going through processes of constitutional changes with the constitutional referendum last year. So I just wanted to ask, what is the national narrative, especially about the first Ottoman constitution, since this is an understudied topic as compared to the second Ottoman constitution? So in what ways this book is challenging that national narrative, or in what ways it's changing that narrative?
Well, I think the book challenges also the Westernization paradigm, mm-hmm. in the sense that we think that during the Westernization process, which also included the Tanzimat period, There is a wholesale adoption of Western legal models. However, the process is quite different. I think there is a threshold beyond which the great powers could not penetrate the Ottoman state because it had a very strong central administration. And this threshold is cultural. And we see through this process that they are trying to adapt the European constitutions to the cultural reality of the empire. And we see that the constitution making is also a problem, has also a dimension of identity, and they really want to preserve their cultural authenticity when writing the constitution. So I think these challenges this westernization paradigm. On the other hand, when we look at the conventional historiography, we see that there is a continuous development, not even from 1839, but starting from the deed of agreement of 1808. This national historiography describes a continuous maturation starting from 1808 until 1876. However, when we look at the draft constitutions, I think the most important novelty of the book is a pile of draft constitutions that I found in the Ottoman archives. And when we look at this pile of constitutions, draft constitutions, in fact, we see that draftsmen did not see a continuity from 1808 until 1876. In fact, they see this constitution-making process as a break with earlier reforms, which became dead letters, and also because these reform decrees were charters granted by the Sultan. And some of the draftsmen really wanted a break with this decree reforms in the sense that they really wanted to write a constitution in the European sense. And also, I think we should not trace this political maturation in the final text of the Ottoman constitution. I think the earlier drafts were more liberal texts, and especially the one that the drafting commission drafted was a text of 130 articles. It had really a liberal tendency before the intervention of the Sultan and the cabinet. I think we can challenge this conventional historiography by considering that the Ottoman constitution and some of the draftsmen, they really wanted to make a break with earlier reform decrees.
So usually the Tanzimat historiography shows this period, or the historiography under Tanzimat shows this period to be, as you said, like a culmination of this constitutional processes. And the draft constitutions you're looking at usually, challenge this narrative. My question is, are there any anti-constitutional movements in this period? Because if we look at the Ottoman constitution of 1876, we usually focus on the people who were for the constitution, Mithat Pasha being the most important. Were there any anti-constitutional movements or bureaucrats?
I think there were strong power struggles between Mithat Pasha and the traditional political elites. I think the project of Mithat Pasha was already the foundation of a republic. I think he targeted the foundation of a republic with this constitution. And the traditional elites thought that their interests would be challenged by such a powerful textual document. So I think we can talk about an anti-constitutionalist movement within traditional circles. But I think many members, this constitution-making process included various administrative units. So there was a constitution writing committee, but in addition to this, the Council of State was also involved in the process. And it was really a unit, an administrative unit, which included people from various backgrounds, from various religious affiliations. I think this the outcome of this drafting commission is really a very major text, and a text which challenges this traditional elites who are against the constitutional project.
So when talking about elites, it's inevitable to think about the actors who are in this process. So we talked about the process of negotiating, how there were different layers. So maybe a few words on the actors themselves. Who were these actors? You talked about the foreign powers. So what were their interests in kind of wanting a constitution, an Ottoman constitution? What was the role of the Christian millets or the Jewish millet in that sense?
I think the actors are very diverse, and we can talk about, for instance, about the individual agency of Henry Elliot, who was a British ambassador to the Porte. I think there was a strong interaction between Mithat Pasha and Sir Henry Elliot. And I think Henry Elliot was involved and he was in favor of the Ottoman constitutional project, and he acted against the policy of his own government, because Britain did not really support the Ottoman constitutional period. And we can talk about a strong interaction between Mithat Pasha and Henry Elliot. I looked at his private papers in the public record office. I read his memoirs. So he, in a way, tries to explain us that if the great powers were in favor of this constitutional project, Abdülhamid could not have suspended the constitution. I think in this period, unlike the earlier periods in which the European powers supported the reform decrees, there is a change of policy in European diplomacy, because now they want to shape differently the Balkans. So the autonomy of the Balkans, of Bulgaria, of Bosnia and Herzegovina is on the agenda. So they are not in favor of this constitutional project. But there are some members of European diplomacy who supports in a way the modernist elites of the Ottoman Empire. On the other hand, people like Odihan, who were also involved in the drafting process of their own communal constitution, in a way they could transfer their expertise, their earlier knowledge to this drafting process. In fact, I always encountered in secondary literature that that in a way Mithat Pasha, hand in hand with Odihan Efendi, wrote this constitution. But when I went to the archives and found a pile of documents which are undated and which do not really bear the seal of the drafting commission, but you can in a way constitute a kind of calendar. You can date this these drafts in a parallel way with the information you collect from newspapers or from secondary literature. So you can reconstitute in a way a kind of calendar to date, to roughly date this pile of draft constitutions. So you cannot really see the signature of this or that person. I think if we could find such signatures, it would help us to trace how people of different religious backgrounds conceptualized a constitutional reform. But we don't have such signatures. We can suppose that we rather have collective texts. But again, if we come back to the draft elaborated by the drafting commission, which housed in a way people of different religious backgrounds, Greeks, Armenians, Ottomans, and also people from different professional backgrounds. So we have all the influential layers of the Ottoman society, the military, the ulema, the bureaucracy, so Muslims and non-Muslims. I think the outcome is really a very liberal text, which means that the earlier experiences of these people when drafting their own communal constitutions were in one way or another transferred to the writing process of the Ottoman constitution. And also I think by initiating a new mode of governance within the community, they also initiated a kind of new culture about the treatment of non-Muslims, and also perhaps they initiated a discussion about how legality, a kind of separation between what is administrative, what is religious. So they brought, I think, some kind of secular conceptualization of law, so I would say.
The 1860s is usually seen as a period of constitutions. You have the special constitution for Mount Lebanon, and then you have the constitution in Tunis, as well as the millet constitutions, the Jewish, Armenian, and the Greek Nizamnames, or the millet constitutions. So what was the relationship between the millet constitutions and the Ottoman constitutions? Did the Christians, the Armenians, Greeks see this constitution, the Ottoman constitution, as a challenge to the community? Did they try to preserve their privileges? So I'm trying to understand what was the relationship between a communal constitution and an empire-wide constitution.
As I said, I think this communal constitutions, they functioned as the first laboratories, I think, of Western constitutionalism. And they could bring clear-cut categories such as what is administrative, what is secular. They tried to find a kind of equilibrium between modernity and tradition. So it was a kind of exercise, I think. And also it brought a new vocabulary, because previously the communal regulations were called in a way Ganon Akrutyun in Armenian, for instance, which is, I think, a Greek word. By choosing the word Sahman Atrutyun, I think Armenians reinvented a traditional concept, because it's an old word, after all, Sahman Atrutyun, which means also law, but also limitations. It brought the idea that law is something that limits, and it had limits in the sense that it limits the power of people. I think, in a way, the word itself shows that the bodies who the bodies which are implicated in the governance, in communal governance, they should be redefined with their own limitations and limits. I think the relationship between limits and law, I think this is important. I think there was a very pacific relationship between communal regulations, communal constitutions, and the constitution of the Ottoman Empire, in the sense that we see also in patriarchal minutes of the 1876 that Armenians considered themselves as one of the first communities that had a constitutional experience, and they expressed the idea that as they had this constitutional experience in community governance, they knew the value of a constitutional framework. And I think through the generalization of a constitutional framework in the whole empire, they saw in a way the Ottoman constitution as a guarantee for the protection of their own communal constitutions, because there is an article in the Ottoman constitution that was added, I think, in the last minute, which stipulates that Islam is the religion of the state in a way, but other religions, they are protected together with their former privileges, which means that the former constitutional texts of the communities, they are also under protection. I think they see the Ottoman constitution as a way of guaranteeing the good functioning of their own national constitution.
Speaking about limitations, I can't help but ask about the impact of the first Ottoman constitution, especially in the provinces. We know that the Armenian constitution, the Askanisam Atrochun, created a lot of problems in the provinces as well as solved some others. Do you think the Ottoman constitution worked in a similar way, in the sense that it provided a legal channel through which provincial notables found their way all the way to the Ottoman parliament? So in a way, it reproduced or perpetuated the power of the provincial notables.
I think even the vocabulary indicates, the vocabulary used in the Ottoman constitution indicates that these local notables are reintegrated in the constitutional will, in the sense that we have a Meclisi Ayan. So we have the term Ayan, which means notable. And also we have an electoral law, which was inspired in a way by the Armenian national constitution, in the sense that people who pay a certain amount of tax can be electors and can form an electoral college. In that respect, I think that the constitution doesn't eliminate these traditional elites. They reintegrate them, and especially in the Meclisi Ayan, which is the Senate. But I think when you look at the exchanges, the dispatches between Mithat Pasha and Henry Elliot, the British ambassador to the port, you see that Mithat Pasha has the project of making in the future, in the near future, the Senate an elective chamber, mm-hmm. like the Belgian constitution. Of course, he could not realize this project because he will be also banished in February 1877. But I think he had in mind the elimination, in a way, of this notable by making the Senate a kind of elected chamber like the Belgian constitution.
So if I understood it correctly, this is one of the paradoxes of the Ottoman constitution. In a way, the Tanzimat project was to destroy the local powers of the provincial notables, but through the Ottoman constitution, they reintegrated them in the Ottoman system, and some of those notables actually used the power granted by the Ottoman constitution to perpetuate their local interests, local power.
In a way, the Armenian national constitution itself could not really eliminate, I think, these local notables, because I think they had to benefit from their financial means, financial capabilities, to be able to realize some new changes, either at the communal level or in the general empire, in the whole empire. But it's not only a paradox of the Ottoman constitution, in my view, because when you look at European constitutions themselves, you see that, in a way, landowners, they are in one way or another reintegrated in the constitutional apparatus. It's not only the paradox of the Ottoman world. I think most of the time, even if you look at the provisions, the articles of European constitutions, you see that the landowners, they are not entirely eliminated from the process. But of course, in Britain, for instance, landowners are modernist. They are in favor of changes and improvements. So perhaps there are differences in their way of seeing the constitutional mechanism in Europe and the Ottoman Empire. But it's not only, it's not, I think, an Ottoman paradox.
Mm-hmm. But the conventional view of the Ottoman constitution, the first Ottoman constitution, is that Abdülhamid actually abrogated the constitution because...
He suspended
because he saw it as a challenge, the Ottoman parliament. Do you think that's too early to actually make that case or make that judgment? Do you think in 1878 Abdülhamid was actually turning into an autocrat and he actually saw the Ottoman parliament as a challenge to his rule? Are there any other dynamics involved in this?
I think international politics are also one of these dynamics, because we know that there is no constitution in Russia. And if we look at the exchanges of Ottoman ambassadors to St. Petersburg in this period, we see that Ottoman bureaucrats in a way reflected the fear that Russia had at the moment when the Ottoman constitution was proclaimed. So I think Russia was one of the major obstacles in terms of the constitutionalization of the empire. As I said, the great powers, they conceptualize another international arena. So they want to shape differently, to differently shape the Balkans. I think we can talk about international politics also, not only Abdülhamid, but also the impact of international politics and the impact of the change of policy in European diplomacy. So if the great powers supported the Ottoman constitution as they supported the 1856 reform decree, I think the fate of the Ottoman constitution would be totally different.
Maybe to end with one final question. We know that the first Ottoman parliament or the constitution was very short-lived, but intellectually it had a big impact. So what do you think was the legacy of this first constitution after its suspension in 1878? Did people always talk about it, or maybe the revolutionary groups, it was on their agenda? So in maybe intellectually as well, what was the legacy of the first constitution?
In fact, this book is a little bit mechanistic in the sense that it only focuses on the bureaucratic process, how bureaucrats conceptualize the constitutional reform. But I think, in a way, the press, the debates that initiated within the press, I think it left a kind of legacy, because after all, when the second Ottoman constitutional era started, they accepted first the text as it was, and then they amended the text. I think there was a kind of political maturation. But as I said, the book doesn't talk about the intellectual process. I think if we really want to focus on this intellectual process, it's not only through the Ottoman constitutional text itself, but we should go back to the Ottoman press. We should go back to in a way, law schools that were opened after this period, and even a little bit before. We should look at also the reshaping of the Nizamiye courts, yes, and yes, the Nizamiye courts. I mean, the Ottoman constitution itself will not be helpful in grasping the intellectual movement. And as I said, we should not concentrate on the final products. We should always take into account the drafts and also how the process was conceptualized in academic circles. Of course, the Ottomans will have their university in 1900s, but before that there are some law schools which will open. We will have some Ottoman students, they will go to study abroad. So we should look at if they, for instance, wrote a doctoral dissertation or not, how they refer to this period. There are some, I think, theses written abroad. So we should also go back to their academic productions to see how they refer to this constitutional process.
Thank you, Aylin.
Thank you very much.